It's not so much a talk about Pure Land Buddhism, actually, or the sutras. I'm doing a series of four talks from themes that I've identified as I'm working through these sutras, thinking about them. I've identified four themes. There were more than four themes. And I could have given a series of eight. In fact, I offered to give a series of eight talks, and Artivani said, eight! So I've just hogged the whole of February, every Monday in February, to give these talks. And so this evening is on happiness. Next week is on beauty. The following week, as far as I remember, is on naturalness. And then the final week is trust. Boiled it all down to those four words. And in a way, it's a shame I'm not speaking about beauty this evening when you look at this shrine. Have you noticed those flowers? Aren't they absolutely extraordinary? Amazing. You probably can't see them, but if you sit low and you've got the blue behind, that incredibly orange and yellow and green, quite wonderful. Anyway, this happiness tonight, not beauty. And yes, these talks come from my thinking about the Pure Land Sutras. I've been writing this book just over a year. I've been writing it now. Should finish by the end of March. So I haven't actually had much time to sit and do nothing. So in my spare time, when I'm not working, I usually sit and write or think or do a bit of research on this book. So I just need to say a little bit about what the three Pure Land Sutras are, so you know where all this is coming from. And can you hear me at the back? You can hear me? Okay, good. So they are Mahayana sutras. A sutra is the word literally means thread, and it's a discourse of the Buddha, the thread of meaning in the discourse of the Buddha. And Mahayana is a number of schools, maybe 400-500 years after the time of the Buddha, the time the Buddha lived. These new schools began to emerge, they began to develop, and they began to take the Buddha's teaching and develop them in lots of different ways, really. And the three so-called Pure Land Sutras are an aspect of this development of the Buddhist teachings. Very, very popular in China and Japan. Apparently, if you were to count up all the Buddhists in China and Japan who follow Pure Land teachings, we call them Pure Land Buddhists, there would be more of them than any other denomination of Buddhist in the whole world. So absolutely massive, vast swathes of people following these texts. When I say these texts, they don't necessarily read them, because this is how it happens, isn't it, with Buddhism, well, with any kind of religion. You've got the actual texts, and a few people read the texts, and they tell everybody else what's in them. And everyone else just takes their word for it and just practices like that. So I'm not sure how many people know these texts. They're based on the idea, these texts are based on the idea, the Mahayana idea of multiple Buddhas. Not just one Buddha, but multiple Buddhas in all the directions of space. So with Mahayana, you get this idea that the whole universe is involved in the practice of Buddhism. The whole universe. They have this amazing kind of scope. They see out there, you know, beings everywhere, and Buddhas, and people following Buddhas everywhere. It is a very imaginative kind of way of practicing Buddhism. Of course, we are here, stuck on this world here. We're just practicing. But the way Mahayana Buddhists practice is they practice here in this world, but with this kind of perspective of the whole universe in some way practicing the Dharma. So many Buddhas, and with those Buddhas come many world systems. And there are basically two kinds of world system, and they're called kshetras. Kshetras. Kshetra literally means field. And they are Buddha fields. So when there's a Buddha in a world system, it's called a Buddha field. There are some universes without a Buddha in them, and some with a Buddha in them. So you get Buddha kshetras, Buddha fields. And then there are two kinds of Buddha field. There's pure Buddha fields and impure Buddha fields. I'm not going to go into this in a technical way, just easy enough to say that pure Buddha fields are world systems where happiness and pleasure abound, and impure Buddha fields are world systems where not only pleasure but also suffering is involved. So guess what kind of Buddha field we live in? We live in an impure Buddha field, as you know from your own bitter experience. Suffering is everywhere, isn't it? So the Pure Land Sutras take one of those Buddha fields and one of those Buddhas, and they really focus in on them. So the practice really is to imagine. It's a very imaginative practice. You have to imagine being in this world and imagine this Buddha. And the Buddha is Amitabha or Amitayus. He has two names. Amita means measureless, boundless, infinite. And Abha means light, and Ayus means life. So he's either infinite life or infinite light. So it's time and space, isn't it? Infinite time, infinite space. And this Buddha here is a statue of Amitabha, in fact. So it's handy that he's there. So he can be our backdrop, and the flowers can represent the beauty of his land, which is called Sukhavati. Sukhavati, which means sukha is happiness or pleasure, and vati means lots of, abounding in. Yeah, I think that's enough of an introduction, isn't it? Gives you enough to go on. So I'm going to read you something from the beginning of one of these sutras that I've been writing about. It's called the Shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra. One of the exciting things about this writing of this book is that not only am I writing the book, but a Mitra living in Oslo, at Oslo University, is a translator. He translates from Sanskrit, Tibetan and Chinese, and he is translating these texts as I write the commentary on them. In fact, I'm writing the commentary a bit before he translates. So I use somebody else's translation, and then he translates and sends it to me, and then I have to rewrite that bit. It's really not a very efficient way of writing a book, but you really get to know the text very, very well. So David Welsh, he's translated the whole of the first one, and he's translated the title as the Shorter Sutra on the Abundance of Wonderful Qualities of Sukhavati. So here, you've got the Buddha, our Buddha of this world, talking about Sukhavati. And he's talking to one of his chief disciples, Shariputra. And he says, "To the west, Shariputra, there is a Buddha field, a world system, named Sukhavati, which lies beyond countless hundreds of thousands of other Buddha fields. At the present time, a Tathagata, an Arhat, a perfectly awakened Buddha named Amitayus dwells there, teaching the Dharma. What do you think, Shariputra? That world system is called... No, why do you think, Shariputra, that world system is called Sukhavati, the realm of happiness? In that world system, Shariputra, in Sukhavati, living beings experience no physical or mental suffering. And there are endless causes of happiness. That is why this place is called Sukhavati, the realm of happiness." There's a lot I could say about that, but I'm not going to say very much about that at all. What I'm going to do instead is do a few reflections on the place of happiness in Buddhism, because this is all about happiness. The whole text is about happiness. And so it's worth us taking a good look at this idea of happiness, I think, and its place in Buddhism. Because I think there are some people who think that Buddhism's not really about happiness. It's about wisdom and freedom. Happiness is really by the by. But actually, I would say that happiness was very, very important to the Buddha and his teachings. And we can see this in a number of times in the ancient Pali texts, where the Buddha said on a number of occasions that the only reason he taught the Dharma to people was to alleviate suffering. It's the only reason he taught. It wasn't to get into philosophical debates and He wasn't teaching to tell us about how the world began or how the universe is going to end. He just left those questions aside because he wasn't into that kind of metaphysical speculation. He was just into helping people alleviate their suffering. So suffering, of course, is dukkha. And happiness is sukha. So these are the two opposites. So you could say that the Buddha was... the only reason he taught was to make people happier, to help them learn how to be happier. So both dukkha and sukha are very, very wide meaning words, actually. So dukkha is suffering of any kind whatsoever. It's a suffering of being just slightly too cold, just a degree too cold. It's a suffering of having an itch that you can't scratch right now because you're standing in public in front of 40 people and you can't scratch that bit. It doesn't look good. So you just got to get up, get on with that scratch, that itch, and let it work its way through, and eventually it will stop. It's also the suffering of toothache, any kind of physical pain. It's the suffering of not getting what you want. It's the suffering of getting what you don't want. It's a suffering of getting what you want and then realising later you didn't really want it after all, but now you've got it. So it's all kinds of suffering. And importantly, it's a suffering of the feeling of lack. It's a suffering of feeling that life's okay as far as it goes, but there's more to life than this kind of thing. And it's that suffering that caused the man who later became the Buddha to leave home and search for the truth. So that's what he did. He left home. He lived in apparently a palace or a number of palaces. He was treated very, very well. He had everything a young man could want, except he felt it wasn't enough. And he wasn't a spoilt young man. It wasn't that. He just felt there's more to life than just having pleasure and happiness all the time. So he left home. And he practiced under various teachers, and he went as far as he could with those teachers. Then he left them, then he went on. And then one day he decided that he would take up what are called the extreme ascetic practices, which are self-torture. Fairly popular in India at that time, which is where you would practice things which cause you quite a lot of pain. Things like lying on a bed of nails, you know, that lying on a bed of nails thing. Sleeping on a bed of nails, or sitting in the midday sun in the middle of the hot season in India with a fire on each four fires around you and just sitting there meditating in that kind of situation. So really, really difficult practices. The idea behind them being that a kind of duality. You've got the flesh and you've got the spirit, and the spirit is somehow... captured by the flesh, imprisoned. And what you had to do is make the flesh really suffer, and then the spirit would fly free, become enlightened. That's the idea behind it, I believe. So the Buddha gave this a good go. He did it for 6 years, apparently. And then after the end of that 6 years, he thought, yeah, this isn't really working. So he gave that up. So this is very interesting, because when you think about his life as a whole, as a young man, pleasure, luxury, and then a few years later, extreme suffering. And he looked at both and he thought, neither of those really work. So then he had to think again. And he was sitting, reflecting on his life so far, thinking, what shall I do next? Where can I go next? What can I do with this? And he had a spontaneous memory of being a young boy watching his father work. And I'll read to you, actually... This is him speaking, right, the Buddha. I recall once when my father, the Shakyan, was working, and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Then, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana. This is the first meditative absorption. So, he entered that first meditative absorption spontaneously without even trying to get there. He just sat there and it happened. And he says, I entered and remained in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure, or you could say rapture and happiness, born from seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. This is a general description of that first jhana. And then he asks himself a question, could that be the path to awakening? That experience, could that give me the clue to the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization that is the path to awakening. So that was a clue for him. The pleasure that he experienced, non-sensual pleasure that he experienced, you could say mental, emotional pleasure, this he intuited was the way to awakening. So what I'm going to do this evening is look at happiness from the Buddhist point of view, what it is, its value, and where it stands in our spiritual lives, or where it can stand. And let me begin with another quote from the Buddha, famous quote, we all know this quote probably, from one of the chapters of the Dhammapada, and the chapter is actually called Sukha, happiness. How very happily we live, free from hostility, among those who are hostile. Among hostile people, free from hostility, we dwell. How very happily we live, free from misery among those who are miserable. Among miserable people, free from misery, we dwell. How very happily we live, free from busyness among those who are busy. Among busy people, free from busyness, we dwell. How very happily we live, we who have nothing. We will feed on rapture like the radiant gods. It's wonderful, that, isn't it? So, let's see. So you've got already this idea of, in that rose apple tree business, you've got this idea of happiness free from sensuality. So the Buddha had a lot to say about the happiness of sensuality. Sukha, by the way, I said dukkha is a very wide word, and I forgot to go on to talk about sukha, so I'll just say a few words. Sukha is equally wide, has massive meaning, so it can mean pleasure. Simple pleasure, the simple pleasure of being warm, the simple pleasure of that itch stopping, the simple pleasure of eating a lovely baked potato with a bit of salad and so on top of it, the pleasure of just sitting around with friends in the warm, the pleasure of, you think of it, any kind of pleasure at all, but also it also means something other than, a bit more than pleasure, it also means happiness. Yeah, the feeling of happiness. So sukha means all of those things. The Buddha didn't seem to make a distinction, at least with that word. Sukha meant everything pleasant and dukkha meant everything unpleasant. So we need to be careful here with this idea of sensual pleasures and then other kinds of pleasures, because sensual pleasures, for the Buddha, there was nothing actually inherently wrong with sensual pleasure, in that there was nothing immoral in itself about sensual pleasure, nothing bad or wrong about sensual pleasure. From his perspective, it was fine, except it often doesn't really work. It doesn't work in the long term. So let me read you something else from an early text of his, from the text called the Sutta Nipata. He says, if one longing for sensual pleasure achieves it, yes, he's enraptured at heart. The mortal gets what he wants. But if for that person, longing, desiring, the pleasures diminish, he's shattered as if shot with an arrow. So what he says in the first two lines of that verse is, if you try to get sensual pleasures, you might get them. And when you get them, that's it. You're happy. You get what you want. When you get what you want, you're happy, yeah? We all experience that, don't we? And sometimes we get what we want. But isn't that so? Sometimes it actually does work. sometimes we, I don't know, we want a certain something and we go out and try and get it and we actually succeed in getting that. So it does work. The problem with it is the second two verses. But if for that person longing, desiring, the pleasures diminish, then he's shattered as if shot with an arrow. So this is a very extreme way of talking about it. It doesn't always feel like you're shot with an arrow, but at least there's a bit of pain there, isn't there? So the problem with sensual pleasures for the Buddha were that they were inconsistent and therefore unreliable. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. Or they work most times, but they're of limited duration. So you get what you want, but a little while later you want it again. Yeah, and in that time, let's say you get what you want and you're happy for a while, how long does that happiness last before you start wanting that again? And then of course, once you start wanting it, it's not always convenient to get it, is it? You can't have it immediately. So then you've got a period of wanting and desiring, and wanting and desiring is a form of suffering. So you've got this seesaw effect of getting something and then it fading away, and then you haven't got it, and then so then you have to try again. So you've got this dukkha sukha thing going on. Most people seem to be okay with that, but the Buddha wasn't. The Buddha thought, no, this only half kind of works, doesn't it? It doesn't really work properly. So he wanted a solution to make life work properly. So I'm going to read you another. It's a lot of Buddha in here, isn't it? Another verse for another part of the same text, the Dhammapada, same text as earlier. This is the fourth quote from the Buddha we got here. The Dhammapada. He says, if by renouncing a limited happiness, happiness here is sukha, so it could be a limited pleasure too. If by renouncing a limited happiness or a limited pleasure, one would see an abundant happiness, let the spiritually mature person, having regard to the abundant happiness, sacrifice the limited happiness. It's a bit of a wow, it's a bit of a roundabout way of saying something, that, isn't it? Basically, what the Buddha says here is a spiritually mature person distinguishes between a limited happiness and an abundant happiness, and he or she will renounce, let go of, sacrifice that limited happiness so that they can get an abundant happiness. That verse seems to me extremely important, very important, because the whole spiritual life is there, the whole spiritual life. The spiritual life is not about renouncing happiness and pleasure. It's good to know that, isn't it? The spiritual life is about getting a greater happiness and pleasure than the one you've currently got. So it's about learning to distinguish different kinds of happiness and then going for the abundant ones. So then another question arises, doesn't it? What is a limited happiness and why is it limited? What makes it limited? I would say a limited happiness is limited in duration of time. Yeah. And also by the fact that it's got an opposite which kicks in. Yeah, so you've got these opposites going on. It often happens, doesn't it, that the pleasure you get afterwards, you get some pain as well. Or the pleasure is something to do with the ending of pain. So you've got these opposites going on. So it's limited in that sense. And another way I think that happiness can be limited is that we make a deal with the world in some way. We're willing to give up something like freedom or integrity, something like that, or looking after other people in order that we can be happy and experience pleasure. So sometimes we make a kind of deal like that, don't we? And that deal is usually an unhappy deal for us. So, for instance, I said earlier that for the Buddha, sensual pleasure was not in itself unethical or unskillful, nothing actually morally wrong with it, unless the pleasure and happiness that you're getting is at the expense of someone else. In other words, the pleasure and happiness you might be experiencing might be because someone else is experiencing some kind of suffering. And this actually is quite a big area for us to think about as Buddhists, isn't it? Because you can get very, very cheap clothes from certain shops. But if we look into why they're so cheap, we might find that somebody is getting exploited. So we've got a really nice top on because someone, probably in another part of the world, is having to work all hours of the day for very, very little money. So they're suffering like that so that we can look like this. That's a kind of limited happiness, isn't it? All sorts of things like that in the modern world, because we're all so interconnected. So we need to be very, very careful and discerning about what we buy and what we buy into, the kind of things, banks and so on. Who are you banking with? Who are they banking with? What are they putting your money into? All makes a difference to the world, doesn't it? Okay, now there's another sutta where the Buddha talks about happiness quite a lot. And it's called the Niramisa Sutta, and he talks about 12 levels of happiness. So this idea of renouncing a limited happiness for an abundant happiness really comes into play here, where the Buddha really goes into this in quite a bit of detail. 7:20. What time should I stop, do you think?
8-ish.
Blimey, that's a long time, isn't it?
Phew.
Well, I might do, yeah. We'll do a rain check in about 15 minutes and see how you're getting on. So the four, these 12 levels of happiness are divided into three big levels, three sort of principal levels, you could say. And they are worldly happiness, or you could say sensual happiness. The word actually is meat. Strange, isn't it? Meaty happiness. They're therefore carnal, fleshy kind of happiness. Even saying that sounds morally wrong, doesn't it? Fleshy happiness. Have to remember, nothing wrong with it, nothing wrong. But then there's unworldly happiness, unfleshy happiness. You could say spiritual happiness. And then the third great principal level is still greater unworldly happiness. And this is Lokuttara. The Lokuttara happiness. Lokuttara means beyond the world. Loka is world, and Uttara is beyond, above. So it's beyond the world. So we could say transcendental happiness. The happiness of wisdom, awakening. Those are the three great big levels of happiness. Worldly happiness, unworldly, and greater. Still greater unworldly happiness. So, and then there are four sub-levels. So in each one of these levels, you've got four sub-levels. You've got joy, which is piti, happiness, sukha, equanimity, upekkha, and freedom, vimokkha. So let's start with the lowest of the levels, which is worldly joy. So the Buddha says about this, it is the joy that arises dependent on the five chords of sense desire, which is called worldly joy. The five chords of sense desire are the five senses, eye, nose, etc. So those pleasures you get out of those five senses are worldly happiness. And joy, this is quite interesting because you've probably come across the word piti in Pali. In Sanskrit, it's priti. Have you come across that word before? Well, you get it in meditation. In the first jhana, do you remember? Going back to what the Buddha said earlier, you remember that rose apple tree episode? That experience of the first jhana he had, secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure, piti and sukha. Yeah. So here, though, it's the joy, the piti, the rapture, of sense pleasures. And I would say that this level of happiness is that excited level that you get sometimes when you get what you want. You buy something new from a shop, article of clothing or a gadget. How many of you use Apple and iPods and all that kind of thing? You know, when you go to the Apple shop and you buy something really, really expensive, ridiculous amount of money you spend on it, but it's so good, isn't it? You get really excited about that. You know that feeling of, yeah, look at this, and showing it off to all your friends. You do, look at this, it does that. So that's the kind of excited happiness. Or it's the happiness of going for a job, getting the interview. Whoa, happiness. Going to the interview, getting the job. Fantastic. So excited. Or getting a new place to live, rented or buying. You go and you find it, you look at it, you like it. Hope we get it. Someone else is after it. I know. And eventually you get it. And yay. Oh, and you're all happy. And you're jumping up in the air and your arms go like this. Yeah. So in modern neurological terms, I think probably this happiness is when dopamine kicks in, floods your bloodstream with that excited up kind of happiness, joy. That's worldly. And then unworldly, let's go to the unworldly joy, which is, as I said, you get this in the first and second jhana, don't you? First jhana, rapture and pleasure, piti and sukha, born from withdrawal or seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. We've had that before, haven't we? So yeah, it's a different kind of happiness. It's the happiness that the Buddha was talking about. And what he's saying to us basically is, yeah, joy happens, doesn't it, out there in the world when you get what you want. But the trouble is, it's unreliable and inconsistent. So better kind of joy would be the kind of joy that you experience from going within. Because when you sit down to meditate, nothing out there can stop you from doing what you want to do. There's a certain freedom, isn't there, when you sit down to meditate. Out there, you might be able to get what you want, but you might not. Other people might stop you from getting what you want. You might not have enough money, etc., etc. You used to have enough money and then you were made redundant. It's all that kind of thing. It's inconsistent and unreliable, but the spiritual life is really down to us as individuals. Nobody can stop us from doing that. So there's certain freedom there. So what he's saying is there's that worldly joy, which is fine, but the unworldly joy is better because it's all down to you there. And also, not only that, it's actually a more complete kind of happiness. Yeah, it's more fulfilling for us. What about still greater unworldly joy, the joy of the transcendental, the joy of awakening? This is quite interesting. So the Buddha says this. How can I put this? The text says when a taint-free monk, and we don't really know what taint-free means, do we? And it's too much for me to go into, but let's say somebody, monk or a nun, or a layman indeed, who has gained some kind of insight. Let's just take it as that, as a non-technical reading of that. Reflects on his or her mind that is freed of greed, freed of hatred and freed of delusion, there arises joy. So here it's the joy of reflecting on your experience and realizing there's no greed, hatred and delusion in your mind at the moment. Freedom and happiness. So if we go back to, I shouldn't put this down here, should I? I'll just put it somewhere else. If we go back to that Dhammapada quote, I don't know if you noticed, I did emphasize this word, but you might not have noticed me emphasizing it, but freedom comes up a lot in that happiness quote, doesn't it? I'll just read you the first line. How very happily we live, free from hostility among those who are hostile. Among hostile people, free from hostility we dwell, etc., etc. I'm going to put that here now, just in case you need it again. Freedom. So those people who say that Buddhism is not about free, it's not about happiness, it's about freedom, are half right, because it is about happiness, but it is also about freedom. Freedom and happiness are very, very much interlinked. And I would say, even when you think about the word limited happiness, limitation is a kind of bounding, isn't it? It's a kind of restriction on us. And abundant happiness, you almost get the sense of wide open spaces. So, that's joy, happiness. Happiness is sukha, as we heard. The difference between joy piti and happiness, sukha, in this context, is that happiness is a quieter happiness. It's not so excited. In terms of neuroscience, you could say that happiness is when the endorphins kick in and oxytocin. It's a quieter kind of happiness, when you just feel, yeah, I'm pretty happy here. It's a quiet happiness. So worldly happiness, same as joy, except it's that quieter kind of joy. Let me think now. It's a bit like you're all excited because you've got this new job. That lasts. How long does that excitement last when you get a new job? A week? 2 weeks? You might not even be excited about getting it. You think, oh, blow. I'll go to work on Monday. But let's say you are excited about it. How long does it last, the excitement? Probably a little while. And then after a while, that quietens down. And if it's a job you really like, if you're one of those lucky people who enjoy their work, then it quietens down to a kind of quiet, contented happiness, with content with your lot. Or let's say you fall in love, and that's all the way. It's exciting, isn't it? Wow, falling in love, and they fall in love with you, even better. And all that dopamine flying around everywhere. And then after, how long does that last? Somebody once said that everlasting love lasts about 2 years. And then it quietens down to, if you're lucky, a kind of quiet companionship, doesn't it? And you grow old in your, hopefully, if you're lucky, you grow old as good friends kind of thing. And that kind of excited love thing goes, which is really good news in the long term, isn't it? Because, honestly, it's exhausting, isn't it? When you, yeah. So, that's happiness, worldly happiness. Unworldly is the first three jhana states. I've been talking about jhanas without really saying what they are. So the jhanas are the, what sometimes they're translated, the meditative absorptions. It's when you really become very concentrated and absorbed and go quite deep in your meditation, become very still and serene. So the second jhana, you've still got rapture and pleasure, piti and happiness, piti and sukha. Born of composure, unification of awareness, or this is viveka, this is, no it's not, is it? It's eka chitta, isn't it? Which is one-mindedness, you could say, single-mindedness, wholeheartedness, single-heartedness. And in the second jhana, thought goes away. So in the second jhana, you've got all this wonderful experience, but there's no thought at all. There's no room in your mind for thought. So very, very still now, very quiet. And then third jhana, rapture, piti, joy goes, because it's too excited. Yeah. And you're getting stiller and stiller now. So you've moved from rapture to equanimity. Yeah. A kind of very, very equanimous, still, mindful and alert. So, equanimous and mindful, he has a pleasant abiding, said the Buddha. That's something nice to look forward to, isn't it? Equanimous and mindful, he or she has a pleasant abiding in the second and third jhanas. Still greater, unworldly joy, transcendental happiness, is the same as for joy. It's just that you reflect on your experience. You see there's no greed, hatred and delusion there, and you're really happy as a result of that. Equanimity. Upekkha. Worldly, same for joy and happiness. Well, this is quite interesting. Worldly equanimity is still to do with the senses, the sense pleasures and worldly happiness, getting what you want and so on. But now you are sitting a bit loose to it. You're kind of equanimous. You do want that, but if you don't get it, it's no big deal. It's not a great state to be in. You would like that, but if you don't get it, it's okay. I don't mind. It doesn't affect my internal happiness. Wonderful state to be in. And as you get older, and just looking around, there aren't all that many older people here. So I can speak from experience. I can say as you get older, you do move more into this, and you realise after many, many years of trying to get what you want and sometimes succeeding and sometimes failing, but actually in the long run, it doesn't make all that much difference to your life. Yeah. Happiness cannot be dependent on getting what you want and having pleasure. the world just doesn't really work like that. Seems to work like that when you're young, but as you get old, you realise it doesn't really work like that. There is a danger, of course, as you get older and you become stiller and a bit less frantic about things, that it's said, isn't it, that the big distraction from the spiritual life for young people is pleasure, and the big distraction for older people is comfort. So you could say comfort is the near enemy of equanimity. So us old people, I'm looking over here at my friend who's a little bit older than me even, that's one of the things we have to beware of, becoming becoming overly comfortable and settling down and so on. Yeah, thinking about Artur Vardin's talk a month ago, wasn't it? The first talk that kicked off this whole this Tree Ratna night and the radical edge. Honestly, I left there exhausted. I thought, oh, I've got to go home and have a rest now, because when you're young, the radical edge is really like quite alluring, isn't it? Yeah, let's be radical. But I find as I'm growing older that I cannot keep up with that kind of level of intensity. Yeah. Take that as a confession, if you will. Okay, and then unworldly equanimity is the fourth jhana, which has neither pleasure nor pain in it, and has purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So this is a level of happiness beyond pleasure and pain. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? It's even beyond happiness and non-happiness. It's that level of happiness. Can you try to imagine that? A state of mind so still, so deep, that the whole idea of pleasure and pain, happiness and unhappiness, no longer applies while you're in that state of mind. Wonderful. Still greater unworldly equanimity is, as for joy and happiness, really, you review your own mind and you see there's no greed, hatred and delusion, and you feel that sense of deep equanimity as a result. This is where we're heading, isn't it, as people who are Buddhists, practicing Buddhists. This is the kind of happiness that we're trying to achieve. Freedom. Vimokkha. What is worldly freedom? The Buddha asks, and then he answers, the freedom connected with the material. Material here is rupa or form. So it's the freedom connected with sense pleasures, you could say. So the Buddha doesn't say any more than this in this sutra. It's a little bit frustrating, really, because, you know, I've been thinking for quite a long time now, what's that mean, freedom? The freedom of sense pleasures. What can that possibly mean? And I just in the last couple of days, I've been thinking that what it possibly means is, with all the others, joy, happiness, even equanimity, there's a certain amount of attachment there. The attachment lessens with each one, doesn't it? For the joy, getting what you want, there's quite a strong attachment to that. Happiness, you let go a little bit, yeah, get a bit more mature around it. Equanimity, let go a little bit more. But with the freedom, you do, there's this, maybe you let go completely. So you let go of that particular kind of happiness. Your dependence upon worldly happiness, you let go of that. And that allows you to move on. Perhaps on to unworldly freedom. What's unworldly freedom? I'm not going to say much about this, because these unworldly freedom is experienced in what are called the four formless jhanas, of which I have had no experience. So I cannot really speak about them. I'll just tell you what they're called. It just gives you a flavour of what they're like. The first one is infinite space. So you're meditating away and apparently you get into this infinite space. Second one is infinite consciousness. And I've been told that what this is about is you reflect, oh, I'm aware of infinite space. Well, if I can experience infinite space with my mind must therefore be infinite. So then you experience your mind as being infinite. And then the sphere of no-thingness. where there were no particularities, there were no things. And then neither perception nor non-perception. Honestly, that's completely beyond me, so I can't say anything about it. Still greater unworldly is when looks upon his mind. Yeah, so the person who's had some kind of insight, some kind of awakening, reflects on their mind and they see that they're free of greed, free of hatred, free of delusion, and then there arises freedom, complete and utter freedom. This is really what we're after. The highest, the 12th level of happiness, is the happiness of complete and utter freedom. So, he who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So this is William Blake's version of that Dhammapada verse that I mentioned earlier, that where the Buddha says a wise person sacrifices a limited happiness for an abundant happiness. This is a much more poetic way of saying that, isn't it? He who binds to himself a joy. So when you get something that you want and you bind yourself to it, you attach to it, you become dependent upon it. Does the winged life destroy? The winged life, the life, the spiritual life, really, the life of freedom and flying. But he who kisses the joy as it flies, kisses the joy as it flies, really means a kiss is a, it's a moment, isn't it? You enjoy the joy as it flies. You don't try and hang on to it. You just let it go. You kiss it as it flies. Brilliant. Lives in eternity's sunrise. So you could say becomes fully awake. So the trick, if I can use such a cheap word, the trick is to enjoy but not become attached to. You know? More than that, though, the trick is to hold back from certain enjoyments and happinesses so that you can experience greater pleasures and unhappiness and happinesses. This is the idea. This is why renunciation is a big part of Buddhism. Not very popular renunciation, because I think the in the back of our mind we think, well, do I give up that? That's, I like that. I won't have that anymore. And that's as far as we can see, isn't it? What we have to see is the bigger picture, that if you give that up, you'll get something better. You'll get something better. Do you all know about that famous marshmallow experiment with the children? Have you all seen that? It's worth looking at on YouTube. Go onto YouTube and type in marshmallow experiment. It's something that some psychologists did with some children quite a long time ago. And what it is, there's a camera, there's a desk, and the camera's on, there's a little girl or boy, really small girl or boy. And in front of them, there's a marshmallow. Yeah, and the teacher says to them, like, I'm just going to leave you here for a bit. Don't eat the marshmallow, though. If you don't eat the marshmallow, you can have two later. And they leave them. And it's so good to watch. It's really fabulous to watch because, you know, they go mad. This marshmallow in front of them, and they're sort of going like this. And they're getting under the desk to get away from it, and they pick it up, and they lick, and they put it back. And they bite just a little bit off it and they put it back. They're trying to hold on so they can get another one, but some of them manage not to eat it and some of them can't help themselves, they eat it. It's very, very funny. So this is all to do with deferred gratification, isn't it? Deferred pleasure. Freud made a distinction between the pleasure principle and the reality principle. We all want pleasure. It's a basic instinct to have pleasure. But the reality principle is when you realise that if you defer that for now, you'll get something better later. So this is it was a test for to see if children could do that. It was done a long time ago, and then they followed up with those children when they've grown up, and they found, this is a bit frightening really, depending on the kind of person you are, they found that those who had managed to not eat the marshmallow, they were much happier in their later lives. That sounds like a big thing to say, doesn't it? It all depends on whether you eat a marshmallow or not. It doesn't really depend on that particular instance, but it's all whether you're able to defer your pleasure for now for something better later. Your happiness depends upon that, which is what the Buddha was talking about. The problem with this is that it's a risk, isn't it? There's a risk involved. And the risk is that you give up this lesser pleasure now for a greater pleasure and happiness later. The risk is you give that up and then you don't get the greater pleasure and happiness later and you're left with nothing. That's the big risk, isn't it, that we take in giving up something now for something later. What if that teacher was lying and the child didn't eat the marshmallow and then the teacher came back and took it and said, actually, I wasn't telling the truth. They've got nothing. So this is the problem with renunciation, that there's a certain amount of faith that you will really get that later. This is what we have to do. Well, there's a risk in everything, isn't there? There's a risk in staying with your lesser pleasure because it might stop. So there's that risk. There's a risk in everything. So we have to take risks. The spiritual life is as risky as any other kind of life. Now, there was a man called Mahanama, a layman, great follower of the Buddha. If you go on to Access to Insight, you know that site, Access to Insight, loads and loads of Pali text translated into English. If you type in Mahanama, there's quite a few suttas where the Buddha Mahanama comes to see the Buddha with a problem. And this is one of those. And it's very interesting, this. So I'm going to read you what he said to the Buddha, the question he asked him. He said, "For a long time now, Lord, I have understood the Dharma taught by the Blessed One like this. Greed is a defilement of the mind. Hatred is a defilement of the mind. Delusion is a defilement of mind. Yet, even though I understand this, there are still times when greed invades my mind and remains." And the same with the other two, hatred and delusion. So his problem is that he's understood this for a long time, that greed, hatred and delusion are no good. They don't help. They don't make you happy. He's known that for a long time. But he's unable to stop them from arising in his mind. So why is this? I know, but I can't stop doing it. Isn't that one of the big problems of the spiritual life? That we know what we should be doing and we end up doing the opposite or something like the opposite. Isn't that one of the big problems? So listen up, everybody, because the Buddha says, even though a disciple of the Noble Ones has clearly seen as he actually is with right discernment that sensuality, in other words, sense pleasures, is of much stress, this is Tanisaro's translation. He translates dukkha as stress. So you could say that sense desires bring about much suffering, much despair, and many drawbacks. Yeah. Now, I spent so much time telling you about that phrase, you've probably forgotten what the phrase was, so I'll say it again. The Buddha says, even though a disciple of the Noble Ones has clearly seen as it actually is, with right discernment, with wisdom, that sensual pleasures bring about unhappiness, despair, etc., still, if he has not attained a rapture and pleasure apart from sense pleasures, apart from unskillful mental qualities, he can still be tempted by sensual pleasures. So this is important. You might want to give up your dependence upon sense pleasures, but unless you've actually experienced something better, you'll keep going back to them. Because human beings need pleasure. It's just part of being alive, is that we need pleasure. Without pleasure, we dry up and become wizened old people. So we need pleasure. So we'll get pleasure wherever we can. That's basically what we do. We get pleasure wherever we can. So what the Buddha's saying, no, you need to distinguish here between different kinds of pleasure and happiness, otherwise it'll end in tears. So that's the basic Buddhist message. So you've got to give up that one to get that one. The problem is, if we give up that one, we might not get that one. And this is what Mahayana's come to the Buddha with, isn't it? Well, I'm trying to give up greed, hatred, and delusion, but I find I can't give them up. And the Buddha says, well, the reason for that is because your pleasures come from the senses. And you're not going to be able to leave those behind. You won't be able to let them go unless you've experienced spiritual pleasure. So, that's the bridge. We don't give up our sensual dependence upon sensual pleasures now until we've experienced something other. So there's a bridge. There's somewhere for us to see. In other words, it's a bit like stepping, isn't it? You step onto the spiritual pleasures. Your left foot is still on the sensual pleasures. Okay, you're in between now. Whoa. You don't make a jump because you might jump into something else. So you make a step. So it's step by step. The Buddha then says something really brilliant, actually. He starts talking about himself and before he was enlightened. He says, I myself, before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, bodhisattva is a being after enlightenment, when he was still unawakened, saw as it was with right discernment that sensuality brings about suffering, etc., etc. But as long as I had not attained a rapture and pleasure apart from that sensuality, then I did not claim that I could not be tempted by that sensuality. In other words, unless I'd experienced it for myself, I couldn't give up the other pleasures. And this is interesting because if we go back to the rose apple tree incident, way, way back, do you remember, before he was enlightened, it was that experience of having that spiritual pleasure and happiness, piti and sukha, that allowed him to start moving towards awakening. Oh, we're doing very well. I'm going to finish because, yeah, it's been long enough, hasn't it? I just want to end with just saying something about the pleasure of other people, the pleasure of good company, the pleasure of sangha and spiritual friendship. That's a really big happiness and pleasure, isn't it, that we in our movement take very, very seriously. So I'm going to go back to the shorter Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra. And the Buddha, after he said what he said at the beginning about this happy land, he then went on to describe it in some detail. And I'll tell you more about that next week when we come on to beauty. But at the end of that, after this description, he then started talking about how we might get reborn into this happy realm. So the thing about the Pure Land Sutras is it sort of veers between literal truth and metaphorical truth. You can take it all literally, or you can take it all metaphorically, or you can take it as both. So the happy land, Sukhavati, some people, I'm sure, think of it as a real place, rather like a heaven, a long, long way away. Other people, perhaps more sophisticated, think of it as a metaphor for the happiness of awakening. Either way, the Buddha says, asks the question, how did you get there? How did you get into this realm of happiness? And he says, living beings, Shariputra, should cultivate a heartfelt desire for that Buddha field. Heartfelt desire is a strong term, isn't it? It translates the Sanskrit pranidhana. You might have come across the word pranidhana before. Usually it's associated with the bodhisattva vow, the vow to save all beings. So it's a very, very strong term, pranidhana. So they should cultivate a heartfelt desire for that Buddha field. Why should they do this? Why? They should do this because in that Buddha field, they will be in the company of good people, such as these bodhisattvas who live there. So he's just spent pages talking about the beauty and the pleasure of Sukhavati. And then he says, why would you want to be born there? He doesn't mention anything about the land. He just says, because there were some really great people there. Yeah. Be really good to be there with those people. You'll be in such good company. That is the only reason he gives for cultivating this heartfelt desire to be born there. So it's worth us remembering this. And the Pure Land, can be understood in many different ways. One of the ways we can understand it is as a myth, as a metaphor for spiritual friendship and sangha. Yeah. In a way, what we've got here right now and what we had downstairs with the baked potatoes is we're developing a Buddha field, a Buddha kshetra. It's not a pure Buddha field because we all suffer in various ways, don't we? But still, it's a Buddha. It's about as near as we can get to Sukhavati. And that is the value of having this fantastic centre here right in the centre of town, because it's a beacon for those people who want to let go of dependence upon sensual pleasures, and there are many, many of them in this city, and go for a deeper kind of happiness. And here we are. Here we are. And here we are, the living embodiment of that quest to move from dependence upon worldly happiness through to unworldly happiness, through to still greater unworldly happiness, the happiness, the freedom of awakening. So I'm going to finish again with the Dhammapada, the Buddha. He says, it's good to see noble ones. Noble ones is Aryas, those who are enlightened. Happy their company, always. So to be in the company of beings who are awakened is always a happiness. Through not seeing fools constantly one would be happy. So conversely, foolish people just make you unhappy. 4. Living with a fool, one grieves for a long time. Painful is communion with fools, as with an enemy, always. Happy is communion with the enlightened, as with a gathering of kin. So, the enlightened man or woman, discerning, learned, enduring, dutiful, noble, intelligent, of great integrity, follow them, as the moon follows the path of the zodiac stars.